I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2296. Representative Gallego?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I've moved the Dashwood Amendments to House Bill 2296.
Thank you. I have a motion from Representative Gallegos to move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2296. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Representative Gallegos?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 2296 as amended to revenue with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. That would work. I have a motion from Representative Gallegos to move the Dash 1 amendments. No, to move House Bill 2296 as amended to the revenue with a due pass. Any discussion? Representative March.
Just to kind of reiterate some of the discussion we had, I think I'll go ahead and give you a courtesy yes on this, but there is the possibility that we're watering down the system as we do this, and we may want to revisit that with revenue.
Thank you very much. Any other discussion or comments? Any objection? Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Dickinson?
Aye.
Representative Howe? Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Representative March?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Bango?
Aye.
Chair Smith?
Aye. So ordered. I'll close work session on House Bill 2296, and I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3613. And I have Representative Greenleck here, who is a sponsor, and Senator Bruce Starr. Would you guys like to come forward? Well, will you guys, do you want to talk about it, or do we want them to?
Yesterday on the Senate floor, good afternoon, Madam Chairman. As of yesterday afternoon, for the record, Senator Bruce Starr, Senate District 615, on the Senate floor yesterday, I was carrying a bill, and I kept getting referred to as the junior senator. And so to be referred to as the senior today,
it's a
promotion.
I guess.
That's awfully nice. Here to testify in support of House Bill 3613, Investing in Oregon Bill. I'm the co-chair of the Bipartisan Growth Joint Growth Caucus. Our mission is to stimulate Oregon's economy and get Oregonians working again. This bill is an important part of our Growth Caucus's economic agenda because it does stimulate the Oregon's economy and it will create jobs here in the state. With a 7.6% unemployment rate, Oregon's one of the highest in the nation. Currently, 154,000 Oregonians are unemployed. 154,000 of our citizens are unemployed. That's quite frankly just too high. We've got to find ways. This legislature has to find ways to develop strategies to get those Oregonians back to work. According to the Oregon Council for Knowledge and Economic Development's 2002 report, an Oregon seed fund with just $20 million in capital helped 50 Oregon companies that created over 3,000 jobs, realized revenues of over $798 million, leveraged an additional $570 million in additional investment. If you look at these numbers and you extrapolate a minimum $100 million in capital with matching funds from investors, you could create, again, extrapolating the numbers from the previous examples, 30,000 new jobs, $7.9 billion in revenue, $5 billion in new money invested in Oregon to help create by the passing of this bill. The treasurer representing the Oregon Investment Council is opposing the bill. He says that it creates a bad precedent for the legislature to direct the investment practices of the OIC, the Oregon Investment Council. To that I say the OIC was created by legislative action, ORS 293.701. The OIC was allowed to invest in stocks due to legislative action. The OIC has been directed in the past to invest in certain ways. In the middle 80s, the legislature directed OIC to divest of South African stocks. This is a political decision, no question about it. Investing locally with the added burden of being responsible if something negative happens to a company that you invest in. What we're saying to the Investment Council is forget about the politics. This is good public policy. Other states have already taken this step. Wisconsin, Michigan, New Mexico, Nevada, Massachusetts, Maryland, New York, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, California, Minnesota all have programs to invest state trust in venture capital within their state. I mean, we're talking about using Oregon dollars to invest in Oregon companies. It's that simple. The treasurer is also opposing the bill because he says it's a prudent investment. Others will be testifying today as to the fiscal prudence of investing in emerging growth businesses. All I have to say is that if the OIC has lost over $2.5 billion $1 billion in the last year investing prudently, maybe it's time to rethink how we talk about what prudence is. In summary, our economy is flagging. We're losing businesses as well as jobs. House Bill 3613 creates jobs, stimulates the economy without negatively impacting our general fund. In fact, the quite converse is true. And hopefully in the not so long term, this will have a significant impact on our general fund. If you want to do something proactive this session to create jobs, House Bill 3613 is one of the best ways to do it, as well as passing transportation funding bill. But that's another issue. I support.
I see the wrong hearing.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I just had to throw that in. I urge your support for House Bill 3613. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of the bill. I appreciate the good work of Representative Greenlick and his staff and the team of folks that they've put together to work on this issue. And I look forward to be on the receiving end of the bill as it moves through the House and over to the Senate. With that, Madam Chair, I'll turn the microphone over to my good colleague, Representative Greenlick, and with your permission, excuse myself to go vote on a bill out of another committee.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Are there any
Appreciate
questions
it.
For Senator Starr before he leaves?
I'd like to make him aware of one thing.
What?
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, I have a concern with the requirement in the bill that $100 million must be invested in these kinds of programs because emerging growth businesses have no track record necessarily, and this involves money that's trust money for people's retirement, and the fact that it's OIC is dealing with it is really no different to me than if it was TIA CREF or some independent investing organization that's being required to invest $100 million in a certain state's industries without setting forth what the kinds of returns were and that kind of thing. So I just wanted to let you know that there's a concern there.
I understand the concerns, and I think that hopefully the work of the folks that are working on the bill and the work in this committee, my hope is that ultimately we could come up with a bill that is universally supported, including the state's treasurer and others that have concerns about it. That would be my
Super
hope.
Super, great
Thank
idea.
You.
Thank you. Thank
I'll
you very
be commenting
much.
On that point as well.
Welcome.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you for giving me this opportunity. I'm Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33. I'm very pleased to be working on this bill with Associated Oregon Industries because it fits very well with some experience that I've had over the last 5 years on the investment committee of a large foundation, actually serving on the committee with past State Treasurer Jim Hill, in which I've really learned a lot about this whole question of how do you use social capital in a way that makes some sense. It's very clear to me that as a part of rational investment policy, we need to think not only about maximizing the return on an investment in specific terms, but we also need to think about the social use of the capital that we have in terms of the greater good that capital can serve. The purpose of this bill is to do two things. One is to create the notion that the Oregon Investment Council ought to have a first look approach for looking at investments in emerging Oregon industries, particularly in that category of asset in the asset allocation model, that's the alternative asset category. As an investment group looks at their composite investments, they decide that the asset allocation is a balance of creating return and minimizing risk. And the whole secret to investing this much money is that risk-benefit analysis. What this bill is intended to do is for a small proportion of the investment, up to 1% of the investment, that the investment council look first at the ability to partner with other venture capitalists in supporting emerging Oregon industries, and two, define the risk-benefit calculation in a broader term than is usually done in this kind of investment. The basic notion is that risk always has to be identified as risk, and as it says in the bill, has to be managed appropriately. We don't want the Oregon Investment Council to take unnecessary risks given the asset category that's being invested. But alternative investments always have higher risk that go with it, and the trade-off for higher risk is higher benefit. The change here is we're not asking them to change their risk assessment models. What we're asking them to do is to change the benefit side of the risk-benefit analysis to include as a benefit not only immediate return in terms of financial return, but to look at the social benefit, at the benefit to the Oregon economy that these investments make. This is a very common thing, as Senator Starr said, for states to be using this money to stimulate the economy of their own state by being particularly attuned to investment opportunities that affect the job picture and the economic structure of their state. There is, I understand, some concern with the language in line 35 through 37 of page 2 of the document, the language to which Representative Richardson referred before. It was not the intent to force the Oregon Investment Council and the Treasurer to invest in bad investments. The intent from the beginning was to have up to 1%, not 1% of that money. The extent to which this causes unease, our suggestion is if we can do it quickly within the time limits we have, we create a dash one amendment that deals with that, or failing that, we move it over to the Senate with the clear understanding that that's the intention, is to not force the Treasurer into uncomfortable investments, but to make sure that this is a first look opportunity for those investments that make sense. You'll be hearing other testimony about other technical details and the value of this, but basically that's what we had in mind. Move to the first look, use up to 1% of that alternative investment allocation category for Oregon venture investments, and bring into the risk-benefit analysis not a deteriorating sense of risk, but an increasing sense of benefit, the extent to which benefit really means benefit to the state as well as economic return to the category of investment.
Thank you.
I'll pause. Are there any questions?
Happy to ask them. Representative Marks?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Greenlick, are you familiar with the conceptual amendments that I prepared, which on line 33 on page 2 would delete the word shall and replace it with the word may, and also on line 36 addressing Representative Richardson's concern, delete the less than the 100 million nor, which means the cap is still there but doesn't imply a bottom minimum. And if you are now that you're aware of that, are you comfortable with those amendments?
Yes, I am.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The one of the things on the staff measure summary, which you may or may not have seen.
I have not seen it.
The one of the things that references at the bottom is that several other states, including Wisconsin, Michigan, New Mexico, Nevada, Massachusetts, Maryland, New York, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, California, and Minnesota have programs to invest state funds in venture capital within their state. Have you done some looking at those? Is it a fairly similar kind of context that they have, similar kind of goals, similar kinds of process, or are there some differences?
I've not done the usual kind of research level I do on things like that. Well, Madam Chair and Representative Hunt, but I am familiar with them generally, and I think it is basically this kind of a model. You take the alternative investments, and you take a piece of that alternative investments and use it locally.
Madam Chair, if I could follow up with one other question. My understanding is that it's pretty unusual for the legislature to get involved in this area. I guess my basic question is, do you think that the need for economic development and the need for investments in Oregon companies raises the level of importance of this particular issue in a way that would be fairly unique, or do you see this as opening the door to a whole variety of other kind of instructional guidelines to the Investment Council?
Madam Chair and Representative Hunt, when I looked into this issue, there are other occasions when the legislature puts some public policy overlays onto the investment. I mean, for example, we have the overlay of a maximum of a certain amount of the category of investment that can be put into equities. That was a legislative requirement that's been put onto it. We did have the South African piece where the legislature decided that these were social funds and needed to have a social screen. At other times, the legislatures rejected the notion of putting social screens in. The legislature rejected the idea of putting a social screen in to prevent investment in tobacco companies. So the legislature has had before them opportunities to put social policy overlays onto the investment plan, and sometimes they've accepted the opportunity to do that, and other times they've decided not to do it. Now, I think you will have testimony later about the OCCAT commission, which has a recommendation that would look to private foundations throughout the state to do virtually the same thing, that urges other investment opportunities in the state to stimulate business in this state in the same way. So I think it's sound social policy. I think it's in the bounds of social policy interference, if you will, acceptable forms of interference with the autonomy of the investment council.
Thank you. Any other questions for Representative Greenwood? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to call Randall Edwards next. Welcome, Mr. Edwards.
Thank you
for coming. And group.
And group. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is State Treasurer Randall Edwards. With me is Linda Haglund, my Deputy Treasurer, and Ron Schmitz, who is my Chief Investment Officer, who oversees the management of many of the funds that we are discussing in this bill. I appreciate the opportunity to come here and talk to you about the importance of investing in Oregon. I think you heard that earlier. This is a public policy that this state has held and is something that I, as a treasurer, take seriously in wearing many hats as treasurer and things that you have asked that I do. So, therefore, I support the intent of this bill, and the state must look at opportunities to invest in itself to try to help promote economic development in Oregon. This bill, of course, focusing on emerging growth businesses, again, a good idea. In fact, many of us in this room have worked with you in the private sector to expand investing in emerging growth businesses. For example, the Oregon Opportunity, again passed by the last legislative body, we worked very closely in helping put the finance of that together so that there's a $200 million investment by the state with tobacco proceeds in bioscience at Oregon Health Sciences University. Last session, we worked with you again to come up with a seed capital fund that would allow us to invest in early stage investing at our universities, and that is about a $15 million fund. I also very much supported changing the Constitution that our universities could actually have equity positions so that when they invest in research and development that they can benefit from that commercialization of those projects and ideas. Really, my concern with this bill is that it dramatically changes how I and the Oregon Investment Council manage trusts and other money that don't belong to the state. And I think that's a clear distinction here I want to make. Specifically, the bill forces the Oregon Investment Council to invest a specific dollar amount, as it's written, of state-managed money in emerging growth businesses. It also conflicts with the prudent investor standards that have guided the council in managing these monies to consider other benefits like economic development. And again, I think you heard from the sponsor and the previous testimony suggesting that economic development needs to enter into our lexicon as we invest these monies that are belonging to others. The problem with this is that the money that the bill wants us to invest in Oregon is not state money. The money belongs to others. The state manages these funds on their behalf. For example, the PERS fund belongs to the PERS beneficiaries and is exclusively earning money for retirees. The Common School Fund is a trust fund that is benefiting current and future students. Again, another trust. These are not state-owned money, like lottery or tax dollars, which can be used for various public purposes. Each fund that we manage has a designated purpose, and we manage those funds for their exclusive benefit. This bill would have us change what has been a long-standing and successful policy for the state to manage money. However, this isn't to say that we do not invest in Oregon with these funds. We use the marketplace to do that. In my annual report of last year, we showed that we have invested about $600 million in Oregon through stocks, real estate, mortgages. We've also put money into local venture partners. For example, Olympic Venture Partners. We recently put another $40 million into this venture capital fund headquartered in Portland. This is the third time that we've done that. So we are putting money to work in the state. And as a policy, the Oregon Investment Council acknowledges opportunities in Oregon, and I want to read you something from our policy statement. The Oregon Investment Council recognizes that excellent investment opportunities may exist in Oregon and actively considers investments within the state. I want to leave the impression with you that we are open for business here in Oregon. We do look at Oregon opportunities. And to shift gears, to avoid this mandate that this bill contemplates and putting a new viewpoint of how we manage money for others, the legislature addressed this a few years back by creating what is known now as the Oregon Growth Account, which I chair. And there's a couple members of my board here. It's all private sector members of the board. And that money that we use to manage for the Oregon Growth Account comes from lottery. And the objective is exactly lifted into this bill, which is the purpose of the Oregon Growth Account is to earn returns for the Education Stability Fund, which is, you recall, it's the Rainy Day Fund, by making investments in or provide seed capital for emerging growth businesses in key industries. When we first started this program, we put about $20 million out, and that's leveraged over $100 million in both private money and also federal money. So we are doing what the intent of this bill was and the purpose of the Oregon Growth Account. And as chair, I'm very committed to continue to manage this money for that purpose. However, I do want to point out a concern that I have as chair of the Oregon Growth Account, and I hope other board members who are in this room will talk about this, and that is these are long-term investments. I think that was pointed out in previous testimony. It takes time to see yields out of these investments, and there are great risks, many of which you may never see your money return. But what you hope is that you find those managers who have the skill to find investments that in the long term will yield you a return. What my concern is one of really our commitment as a state to continuing to use the framework of the Oregon Growth Account, which, again, the legislature has mandated that we set this up, we manage the money for lottery, we look at investments in Oregon. But what happened in the last biennium, as we're balancing this biennial budget, nearly $5 million was taken out to balance the budget. And clearly we're in a budget crisis, and I understand that need. But the long term is, when you look at what you're trying to ask us to do, is continually place money in the marketplace because you want to diversify when you invest. Because if you have a bad year because of economic situations or business climate, you want to make sure you're pacing yourself with these monies. And currently, I got to say, we're out of the marketplace. About the time that money was taken out, we were already looking at four or five other funds to potentially put money in. So this is a more of a policy discussion with ways and means, but I want to point out we have the mechanism, but the concern I have as chair of the council or the board is that we need to make sure that we're committed as a state to continue to use that mechanism to meet this. Again, the intent of this bill is good. And as somebody who sits on both the Oregon Investment Council and the chair of the Oregon Growth Account, I'll do everything to continue to find investments in the state. You've got that commitment. I think one thing that troubles me a bit implied in public policy with this, and it's not the intent, I think, of the writer or the drafter, and I got to say, as treasurer, I think we, and as the legislature, we are stewards of money. And that somehow intended in this as public policy is that there's a mandate that should be put on these monies that do not belong to the state that would not necessarily be there in the private sector, and I think Representative Richardson pointed that out. If this is a good idea for these monies, which are not state monies, and they have a public purpose, then I'd also suggest that it's good for any other private fund that resides in the state. And again, my intent here is to say we all want to put money to work in Oregon. How we do that is really important, and I believe this puts us on the wrong step in trying to force money into Oregon. It has been suggested that it could be a May situation, as Representative March has alluded to in an amendment. Then I'd question what's the intent of the bill, because, again, we do put money into work in the state. I'm committed to working with those in this room to make sure that we put money here in the state, but we got to do it prudently, and we got to be smart about it. With that, I'd like Ron Schmitz just to briefly highlight how we put money to work in Oregon. There is a letter from the chair of the Oregon Investment Council that's been passed out as well, who also has concerns regarding this bill as written. And I'd like to have Ron just speak briefly on how we approach the marketplace here.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, representatives, for the record, my name is Ron Schmitz, Director of the Investment Division of the Treasurer's Office. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I wanted to comment on staff operations, as Randall suggested, and also just make one or two comments on the venture capital industry and correct what I feel are some misunderstandings, perhaps, in some material that's circulated to you by proponents of this bill. As for staff operations, we have had and always have had an open-door policy to hear about local investment opportunities. The Oregon Investment Council, in recognizing its fiduciary duty for fund beneficiaries, allows that all else being equal with respect to quality and productivity of investment options, that OPERF should invest locally when possible. When investment appears in front of our staff and appears to have the desirable characteristics that we're looking for, we forward that opportunity to an outside consultant for further evaluation and research. Those funds or those opportunities that pass muster are presented to the OIC for an investment decision, a thumbs up or a thumbs down investment decision. And as Treasurer Edwards has mentioned, there are several of those that have been made, you know, by OPERF historically. I should point out that it's true that the number of opportunities reviewed greatly exceeds the number that actually receive an investment by the OIC. And that's true whether it's an Oregon-based or a Northwest-based investment versus a national program. I think because of that, there's probably a number of interested parties out there that feel that the state may have given them a cold shoulder. I would maintain to you that that's absolutely not true. With respect to some of the material of the one-pager, I think that I have seen that the Associated Oregon Industries has passed along, there are some things about the venture capital industry that I want to make sure that at least try to give you a little bit more balanced perception of it. There is not a shortage of money for venture capital. The industry in the last few years of the tech boom raised more money in the 2 or 3 year period than had been raised in the prior decade cumulatively. Secondly, there much of this money, perhaps even most of that money, is yet to be invested. The reason for this is that there's too much money chasing too few high quality deals. Many general partners are actually releasing limited partners from their commitments because they can't put the money to work in the reasonable time frame as mandated by the documents of the funds that had been raised. That is, managers are giving money back in some cases to investors because they can't find a place to put it. I would ask the committee to realize and remember that the market is efficient and worthwhile opportunities have a very good chance of getting funded. Second, there's been comment earlier today about the many states having programs to encourage in-state investing, and I think that statement is true as far as it goes. However, what's missing from that comment and what you, I think, need to know is that these states have generally not mandated pension fund money to do this investing. California and New York have policies to consider in-state investing, no statutory mandates. Maryland, West Virginia have mandated state funds to do in-state venture capital, but it is not pension fund money that's being used for that purpose. It's set up similar to the OGA has been set up here that Treasurer Edwards has already spoken of. I spoke to, and I think there was a list of 7 or 8 states that were mentioned earlier. I spoke to 5 of those, my counterparts at those states. None of them have a statutory mandate to invest pension money this way in in-state initiatives. So I guess I would just say this: the state, both in terms of how we operate in looking at opportunities, as well as what the state has done already with respect to the Oregon Growth Account, that the state is not asleep at the wheel, as implied by some proponents of this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Linda. Did you want to testify?
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Linda Haglund, Deputy State Treasurer. As the two prior individuals indicated, looking at the amount of capital that's out there to invest, a couple of the partnerships that we have invested in, one of them in the Public Employees Retirement Fund, which is Olympic Venture Partners that the treasurer mentioned. We signed on to that fund in October of 2001, and the total amount of that fund was $182 million, of which we contributed or committed about 25%. To date, they have invested 12% of capital. They've done three deals. So they have quite a bit of capital left to invest. We just had a conversation with one of the general partners in the last couple of days, and his concern is that he's not seeing transactions. He's seen plenty of ideas come across their desk. But again, quality transactions they're not finding, and that's why they have so much money to invest. It was mentioned earlier by Mr. Schmitz that there's a limited amount of time for these partnerships to invest, and generally that's 5 to 6 years to get the money to work, and then there's about another 5 to 6 years after that for the general partner to work with the company, develop it to a stage that it's ready for sale in the marketplace. So if we're looking at a fund that was raised in 2001, you'd be thinking that it should be fully invested by 2006, and clearly with 12% of the capital after 2 years, that's certainly not on pace. One of the other partnerships that actually is part of the Oregon Growth Account, Smart Forest, this is a fund that is specific to the mandate of the Oregon Growth Account, was raised in May of 2000 for a total of $25 million. The Oregon Growth Account Board committed about $6.5 million. To date, again, over a three-year period, they have about 30% of that money committed. So my point there is that there's money out in the marketplace, and what we're hearing from the general partners is, again, no lack of opportunity, but they're not seeing the good transactions. So there's money in Oregon ready to be invested when those good opportunities come across the desks.
Thank Great. You. Thank you. Any questions for our panel? Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Help me understand, because one thing I'm not clear from based on testimony, you talked about how one of the goals of the Oregon Growth Account is one of the primary goals, which I didn't know, was to actually raise revenue back for the Education Stability Fund. But then there is apparent concern about having a goal that raises money from, say, that takes money from the Common School Fund with really a goal of having return back to that. I mean, up until, was it September? I can't remember when that measure went out. Up until September, those accounts were very similar in terms of goal. Neither of them were an official rainy day fund at that point. So maybe help me understand the difference with the OGA money being okay with that as a goal to raise revenue for the Education Stability Fund, but it not being okay to take what is common school fund dollars and have that be a goal to come back raising revenue.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, the precursor to the Education Stability Fund was the Education Endowment Fund put in the Constitution, lottery funded. Lottery monies fund that fund. We take a percentage of those monies that go into that fund the Oregon Growth Account. So it's lottery money. The Common School Fund is a trust fund established when the state was created for the benefit of trustees currently and in the future. So it is a trust, seen as a trust, and is walled off from, I guess, it by law, it is constitutionally created and dedicated at a different level legally than lottery money. That's the difference.
If I might follow up, yeah. Maybe to some degree it's an issue of where do you draw the line, because I haven't heard in your testimony that you have concerns about some of the past statutory impositions that the legislature has made in terms of caps on the amount of the resources, the amount of the investments that can go into stock or that can go into, Representative Greenlee talked about the cap on equities. Is your concern that this is just stepping over that line, or is your concern that you would rather, in fact, that we go back and take out the previous legislative statutory changes that do put some limits on the council's work?
My fundamental concern is that you're entering into an area that we've, and I would argue, not stepped into, and that is mandating investment policy for the council, which oversees not only PERS fund, but a variety of other funds which have specific purposes. And the statutory limitation on equities, we can work within that framework, although that has been a concern. We have not amended that law because we can actually work within that framework, given asset allocation for these different pots. If it became a functional problem, we'd be the first to come here and say, we got a problem with it.
Any other questions? Representative Richardson?
Madam Chair, Mr. Schmidt, can you clarify for us a few things about how the OIC and OGA actually invest in emerging business opportunities for Oregon? It sounds like you commit a certain amount of funds. At one point you said $25 million to one investment group, and that they have invested 12% of a pool. And so am I correct that you do not invest directly, but you merely transfer funds to limited partnerships of others, and they have responsibility to either invest or not invest? Or is there investments that actually take place at your level?
Madam Chair, Representative Richardson, we invest in both the PERS and the Oregon Growth Account through partnership arrangements, so that we are a limited partner in a fund that has a manager or a general partner that actually does the investments. We do not invest directly in specific deals or company opportunities.
Okay, follow up?
Yes.
So as far as this bill is concerned, even if it went through, assuming that we amended out the language which required a minimum of $100 million, because you've already said that you can't find investments for what you've got, and so we don't want to put pension funds in a position where they're having to be invested in low-grade, very risky investments merely because it has to meet a statute, and so we understand that. But what kind of money, what's the minimum that you're putting out? I mean, it may be that what you're doing is not meeting the needs because it is only really in being involved in huge blocks of money when this is Oregon, and we don't have huge blocks of investment business, a business that needs $20 million or $10 million. I mean, maybe we need a vehicle to invest in smaller emerging businesses that have good opportunity and good potential.
Madam Chair, Representative Richardson, I think that's a good point. The OPERF does work at a scale that is difficult with respect to the size of the opportunities that would be available in Oregon. I mean, from an administrative standpoint, we typically put out at 25 minimum, I think, and more often $50 or $100 million investments into the various general partnerships we look at. The Oregon Growth Account actually does work at a scale that makes a lot more sense for the type of opportunities that we think are available here in Oregon. And I think Linda Hagelin mentioned earlier a $7 million investment in one fund. I think there are numerous, that range from about $4 million, I think perhaps the smallest, up to about $25 million within the Oregon Growth Account. And that is of a scale that I think makes sense for what is trying to be attempted here.
Just one final, and this is basically for Representative Grelick's information, because as this is coming out, passing this bill may not accomplish the goal if it merely says that we really do want you to be investing in emerging businesses if the parameters for that investment are multi-million dollar minimums, because we just don't have that many around that need that kind of money at a startup position that would qualify as far as risk and everything. I mean, by the time it gets to where it would qualify, they don't need the money anymore. And so we have kind of a difficulty if we're really trying to promote emerging businesses if they have to be so huge that they no longer could benefit from the program.
If I might, Madam Chair, I don't want to leave the impression that we're not interested in trying to help build an infrastructure in the state. In fact, many in this room are going to articulate that. There is a need, there's a gap. And I share the concern about growing an infrastructure. In fact, the state has done a very good job over the last decade of growing technology. How are we going to continue to advance, making sure that research and development stays in Oregon? I'm very committed, both in terms of treasurer, period, as an investment council member, as a chair of the Oregon Growth Account, as a member of the OCED committee. Again, I think there are ways that through these different mechanisms we can begin to continue to address that. And I guess, you know, my immediate concern beyond the intent of this bill is more how, as an Oregon growth account, we're going to meet some of the needs if I'm seeing an inconsistency in funding, and yet we've got the framework to exactly meet part of growing this. And you're also going to find here today that that's an inadequate amount of money. Again, another policy discussion that perhaps the state needs to have. My more immediate concern is, will we have any money for the next 2 years, which sends a signal to the marketplace, well, they're an inconsistent investor, and at best you might catch them on a good day, and that's it. And I don't mean to be flip about that, but that does concern me. And again, if the intent of this bill or any other bill is to try to help build an infrastructure of emerging growth businesses with capital, that inability for us to operate is, I think, one that we all should share in concern.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
I'm going to call Bob Livingston.
Hello, Madam Chair. My name is Pat West. Bob Livingston and I, we put either or because we had another meeting that one of us had to go to, and Bob went to that one.
Okay.
Again, my name is Pat West, president of the Oregon State Firefighters Council. So I'm here representing the firefighters in Oregon that are members of the PERS system. We've put down that we were opposed to the bill as it was written, primarily because of the situation that we find ourselves in with PERS, where every dollar that we can get in investments will help reduce the liabilities that we're being faced with, as Representative Richardson can attest to, being on the PERS committee. With the Dash 1 amendments, as we've heard them described, it certainly reduces our opposition to the bill. We think that it allows a lot more discretion to the investment in Oregon. And again, we're in favor of investing in Oregon, as long as it's done prudently and they do it under the prudent investment rules. So we still have a little bit of problem with the Section 3, where it talks basically about managing risk. That kind of changes the definition of what's prudent, and then in the next section it describes that they can make a prudent decision. So we're a little concerned about that, but the fact is that if they do the Dash 1 amendments, I think that we're going to be satisfied with the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. West. Any questions for you? No. Thank you very much. Wayne Embry.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Wayne Embry. I'm a managing partner of Cascadia Partners in Beaverton, Oregon. I appreciate having the opportunity to testify on 3613 today. A way of a little bit of background, I represent a firm that's one of the group of partners is one of the oldest venture capital firms in Oregon. And the credibility I have to testify today is based on 20 years of either being formally researching, working in policy around, and being an active venture capital investor. From 1986 until 1999, my partners and I co-managed the Oregon Resource and Technology Development Fund, which was created by this assembly in 1985. That fund was originally allocated over the course of four biennia, $20.5 million from the lottery, of which we received $12.3 million. With that capital, we made 40 investments in Oregon startups. 20 of those were companies that were spin-outs from research institutions and corporations as raw ideas. In fact, in every one of those companies, we were the first investor, the first institutional investor. In some cases, there were angels, but in more than half the cases, we were effectively co-founders of the company, so building it from the ground up. The results of that, in terms of liquidity back to the fund, were through five initial public offerings, nine acquisitions, and two buyouts. And the returns are on the bottom of the first page. The fund existed in two forms. The first, the Oregon Resource and Technology Development Corporation, because of state constitutional prohibitions from holding equity, we were required to take fairly obscure and complicated instruments in exchange for the capital that we invested. And in a couple of cases, that cost us more than $7 million because we were not able to convert debt into equity in time for a public offering. And that's shown on the chart on the following page. In 1994, through a collaboration with the Attorney General's office, we created a structure whereby we could hold equity for 4 years, and we generated returns that were commensurate with the best returns in the venture capital business in the country. At the beginning of the top of the page two, or listing of the companies, and these are admittedly the winners that we invested in, but again, we invested in all these very early on in their formation and in the results. You'll see that in italics, the results for Radisys and Oregon Dehydration would have been much higher if we'd been able to hold equity. While we managed the Resource and Technology Development Fund, our team co-founded the Oregon Enterprise, now Entrepreneurs Forum, the Oregon Bioscience Association, the Oregon Environmental Technology Association, and the Northwest Capital Network. And we also served as founding members of the Software Association and the Oregon Young Entrepreneurs Association, which has now been merged into the OEF. And we also pioneered the Oregon universities taking equity and spin-outs from the institutions. Based on this performance and track record, we were asked in 1995 to manage a dedicated fund in British Columbia. That was a $10 million Canadian fund. At the time, it was about $7 million U.S. And we invested that money in 12 companies. Again, about two-thirds of those companies were spin-outs from the three BC research institutions. And to date, that fund has returned nearly $19 million U.S. in capital. And we currently manage two additional funds now. They're both pure seed funds, and the major investor in both those funds is a public pension fund. So the discussion here earlier was, you know, why is private equity, about private equity, why is it an attractive investment? You'll see at the top of page three the performance over the last 20 years for private equity. Seed and early stage investing has consistently delivered the highest returns to its investors of any asset class within private equity. It's dramatically outperformed the S&P 500, as well as other later stage venture capital classes. One of the comments that was made a little bit ago was about there being too much money chasing too few deals. When you describe in the current climate what constitutes a good deal, then I would say yes, that answer is quite true. However, you have to keep in mind that the average venture capital fund today is $400 million. That is larger than the average LBO fund of the mid-80s. So with that much capital under management, it's virtually impossible for these venture partners to make investments in startup companies. They have to wait until the company can take a minimum of $2 to $5 million from their fund alone. And then when you add syndications on top of that, you're looking at companies that require $30 to $100 million before a liquidity event occurs. There aren't that many companies out there that require that kind of capitalization, especially in the current market. These were funds that were largely set up on the basis of what was happening in the late 1990s. The market has changed. The fund managers have not changed to take advantage of the new economy. If you look at the chart at the bottom of page three, it shows what the effect has been of investment in early stage capital versus other areas of venture capital. And you can see that most of the money is now going to very late stage, supporting existing investments, making sure that those companies are going to be ripe for public offerings and acquisition when the market returns. And that is that's a wise thing to do. It makes absolute sense to do that, but not to the extent that you ignore startups, because we're now hearing from many late-stage investors that the deal flow is very poor. The reason the deal flow is poor is that there's no one creating the new companies to help them start up, and it's especially true in Oregon. If you look at on page four, there is a chart that looks at the NASDAQ over the last 25 years. And what this chart shows across the bottom are a list of companies. Many of these are very well known and includes a couple of the companies that we invested in here in Oregon. They're still independent, publicly held companies. The thing that's interesting about all these companies is they received their first funding or were formed at the bottom of down markets. And so this is precisely the time to be making early stage equity investments in emerging companies, because they're able to grow and they're able to get the time that they need, frankly, in the marketplace to develop and evolve. I'm in favor of this bill in principle. I understand Treasurer Edwards' concerns and sympathetic to some of his reasons, but Oregon must do more to increase the amount of private equity capital available to the companies that are based here. It'll help moderate the capital swings that exist in the boom-bust cycle we currently see here. Obviously, how we do it's critical, and you know where the money comes from is treasurer's greatest concern. And we do have some of the infrastructure in place. The OGA is a reasonable mechanism. However, it's far too little money available to address the size of the opportunity and the need. And how much money is the right amount is another question. The chart in the middle of the table here shows Portland compared to three other metropolitan areas. And these are is a snapshot taken at the end of the fourth quarter of 2002 of venture investments. This is all venture investments, not early stage. It includes a number of late stage investments. But Austin, which actually has fewer technology workers than Portland has, there were 13 investments and $101 million. Minneapolis had 8 investments with about $54 million. Salt Lake, 6 with $15 million. And Portland, 5 investments with about $21 million. Where we've done a fair amount of work is in Vancouver, British Columbia. And in the time frame between 1995, when we set up the first seed fund there, and now, there are somewhere between 8 and 10 active venture capital firms managing something on the order of about $300 million U.S. in a technology market, an emerging business market that's much smaller than Oregon's. Notice in these charts I've referred to Portland. It is very difficult, if not impossible, to get an out-of-state venture capitalist to come in and look at an opportunity outside of Portland. It requires additional time and travel, and they're unwilling to do that unless it's an entrepreneur that has made them a considerable amount of money in the past and has decided to locate in Bend for quality of life reasons. Then they'll consider going there. But it is very, very difficult to get out-of-state private equity investors to go someplace outside the Portland metropolitan area. The greatest difficulty Oregon finds itself in this post-bubble economy is a lack of emerging headquarters companies. In the last few years, not only has Oregon lost major headquarter companies, U.S. Bank, Willamette Industries, and Sequent, to name a few, but the emerging companies that have been coming up have been sold. This usually results in exported jobs or lost jobs in the corporate infrastructure. And given that there's inadequate venture capital to absorb those employees in new companies that are emerging, they wind up being displaced for a longer period of time, and they're not absorbed by other dynamic enterprises. This is the concept that Yosha Schumpeter referred to in his Gale of Creative Destruction, and it's not happening here. So, Madam Chair, I urge you and your committee members to move on this bill and with an aye vote. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from Mr. Amberg? Representative Berger.
Thank you. I appreciate you being here, and this is a glimpse of this venture capitalist world is an interesting one that I'm frankly not familiar with. That being said, could you tell me, in the case of the money that British Columbia allocated for this kind of thing, was it mandated in any way or was it voluntarily? You understand that, right?
I do. Madam Chair, Representative Berger, the money from British Columbia came from the sale of public assets, and it was, quite frankly, it was the vision of the Chief Investment Officer of British Columbia, who in 1995 set aside a pool of money to invest in 6 venture capital funds across a spectrum of industries as well as stage. We were the last fund funded. We were the first ones to pay all of our money back, and we did the earliest investments.
But it was the investment manager's...
That's correct.
...vision, not parliamentary, whatever they do, bills, whatever. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Keith Barnes.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and representatives. I didn't even know this bill was happening until I was in the halls last week giving testimony on another bill, and I've heard about this one. So I don't have any slick handouts, but let me explain who I am and what my position on this is. I'm Keith Barnes. I'm the former chairman and chief executive officer of a company called Integrated Measurement Systems in Beaverton. We were a venture startup company that eventually went public and then was acquired by another company a little over a year ago. I was also the chairman of the American Electronics Association in Oregon and on the board of directors of the AEA for several years. And I am the vice chairman of the Oregon Growth Account and was the person that spearheaded the initial formation of the Oregon Growth Account when Governor Kitzhaber had his transition team on capital access. So I've done a fair amount of work in the venture capital area. And we commissioned a study back in 1995, which took the three top accounting firms in Oregon, Price Waterhouse, Arthur Andersen, and KPMG, and had them take a look at the size of the Oregon venture capital requirement back in that period. And some pretty interesting data came out during that report. First of all, if you take a look at what happened in Oregon in the 83 to 88 period, there was over $500 million invested in Oregon in that period. So that was well over $100 million a year were invested in venture capital. And companies that came out of that vintage year were companies like my own, Integrated Measurement Systems, Mentor Graphics Corporation, Sequent Computer, InFocus Systems, and a whole range of other companies which have been quite successful in the state of Oregon. Since then, if you take each five-year incremental period, there has been a substantial drop in venture capital in the state of Oregon to the point that it was well under $50 million back in the 88 through 93 period, and it was almost a disaster in Oregon. When I was chairing the AEA in 1994, a lot of companies came to me and said, what's going on? What can we do? And that, along with the change to the Kitzhaber administration, we went and did these reports and studies on capital formation, and we found that there was a substantial requirement in Oregon at that time in excess of $50 to $100 million a year. Since then, obviously, it's grown even beyond that, and what's happened is the funding has continued to go down in the last few years because of the current economic situation. So there was a big amount of venture capital in the early 80s, and it's been going down, coming back a little bit, and then dropping off pretty substantially in the last couple years. So in principle, I would say that this bill makes sense because there clearly, from the anecdotal information that I've seen out there, there is a requirement in excess of $100 million a year in venture capital in Oregon, no question in my mind. I think this is about a lot of things, but primarily it's about jobs, and that's the one thing that these companies have created over the last 10 to 20 years that were funded by venture capital. There are thousands of Oregon jobs, many of which were in the technology community. Those jobs pay about two times the average wage of an average Oregonian's wage, in the $50,000 to $60,000 range versus the $25,000 to $30,000 range on average. There are plenty of good companies that came out of that. The exports to the state through just the tech community are in the $5 to $7 billion per year range. And one of the things that was said earlier in terms of valuations and investing in venture capital is absolutely true. If you take a look at the Morgan Stanley study of venture capital that takes a look at the returns, the internal rates of returns from 1945 through 1990, it averaged about 18%, which was the highest in its asset category. Okay, that was also in this report that we did back in 1995. So very good returns. The best time to invest is when the market is in the tank. One has to continue making those kinds of investments over time, and I think Representative Richardson, your question earlier about, well, what about the smaller investments, you know, versus these really large investments is an absolutely spot-on question. One of the things we tried to do in the Oregon Growth Account is to make sure that we have each of those levels addressed, okay? And what I mean by that is the very small investments, which are handled by the, I can't remember what it's called now, the the Northwest Group that used to be the ORTDA / ORTDC. They handle tech transfer and small investments. We deal with small debt layer types of financing. We deal with some kind of mezzanine financing and true venture capital financing in a variety of different sizes. Okay, so it helps small companies as well as ongoing companies. The problem with the Oregon Growth Account, let me talk about the positives first. First of all, I think the state treasurer and his staff have done a superb job of helping to manage the Oregon Growth Account. They've been extremely responsive, trying to make things work well for the state. On the downside, the amount of money's been very small. To kind of put it into context, what the OGA gets on a quarterly basis is around $1 million to $1.5 million from the lottery, because it trickles down to a very small percentage of the overall lottery funds. The $20 to $30 million that's been talked about in terms of having been invested was an accumulated amount that grew for a period of time until we could get contracts let. And then we put that into four different funds, and now what we're seeing coming in from the lottery is about $1 million a quarter. So it's pretty small in comparison to what this $100 million number is that people are talking about. And on top of that, as was explained earlier by the treasurer, the next increment of cash that's supposed to come from that is gone. Okay? So if there's a company out there that needs capital, there are very few places to go. It's not available. The best time to get a return is when valuations are this low, okay, because obviously you can get a larger percentage of ownership in the companies you invest in, and then when the markets come back, you get a good return. So we're not creating jobs, we're not getting good returns, and we're not investing. So that's a real problem. That's one of the things I like about this bill, is that it really focuses on the investment horizon. Your question earlier about, is there kind of a double standard here? We can take the OGA money away, but we can't say that we're going to put this other money in this direction, I think is very valid. You know, I think that there is precedent that other states and other countries have mandated monies to go into different asset categories. Sometimes it's voluntary, sometimes it isn't. There is data on this that others will present. So I think it makes sense. I think that it can be done. There are good vehicles to handle this. The Oregon Growth Account can do it. The OIC could do it. They both use a treasurer staff. They're extremely capable of handling this kind of thing. You can pick good fund managers so that they only make money if the state makes money. Okay, that's how these things are structured. You can get top-tier venture capitalists involved in bringing money in from out of state if you do this. If we walk away from the venture capital investing in the state, at this point, it will be a devastating blow to job creation in Oregon. So I'm highly in favor of this. A couple of other things that I would want to just talk about. I heard some comments about there's plenty of money in Oregon. I think if you talk to other business leaders, that's not the case. Some of those comments come from venture capitalists. If I was a venture capitalist and I was getting money and I was one of the few, I would not want any additional competition, I can tell you. Okay? And so I've heard this before. I've invested in venture capital firms, none of which are associated with the state, and they don't like competition. So they want to see all the business plans, they want to have the money, and I can understand statements like that. I think that's basically it, other than one other point. And the other fellow that couldn't be here today to testify was Jim Johnson, who was the former head of Intel in Oregon, who's on the Oregon Growth Account with Treasurer Edwards and myself, and had to be in another meeting with Senator Wyden to go through some other bills today. So he just wanted me to pass on that he is also in favor of the bill, and he thinks it's consistent with the economic development goals that the state should be looking at. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions from Mr. Gibson. Mr. Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one question, just so I'm clear. Mm-hmm. You would argue that we need both more resources in the Oregon Growth Account and that we could still utilize the additional capacity of investments under the control of the OIC. That it's not either or, that you would advocate for,
you know,
for both.
To me, I don't much care one way or the other whether it's coming from one source or two sources. I think the important issue is how much needs to be put in play and what is the mechanism that it's put in play and what kind of return should one expect. Right, so I think the $100 million number is a very valid number. It could even be as high as $200 million. Certainly back in the early 80s, it was over $100 million, and we had great successes. So I think it's the amount of money, whether it's put through OGA or whether the OIC handles it, I don't think it makes a heck of a lot of difference. There are mechanisms with both. Maybe the OGA would have an easier time of it because it's specifically set up for that, but it uses the treasurer's staff and they could do it with the OIC. So either way, I think it could work. I think the issue is that we can't be turning it on and turning it off and turning it on and turning it off. We have to be very consistent about an investment strategy, and it's not to say that we have to mandate certain amounts of money get spent in any given year, but you can't turn the faucet off for a five-year period and expect that companies will wait for you to turn the faucet back on. If you were running a company and you got your first $500,000 to start the company up or whatever it was, and you were now at the point where you were shipping product and you wanted to market it and so forth, and you needed another $1.5 million, and there was none in the state because the folks in California don't want to fly up here to do that, you've got a business. And so it's a consistency issue as well as a scale issue as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you. Representative Richardson.
Now, Mr. Chair, Mr. Barnes, what would you think about a situation where the state has invested a fourth, maybe a 25% position in a $180 million fund, and then after 2 years the fund's only invested in maybe to 12%? In a situation where you're saying that there's a tremendous need.
I know they're inconsistent, but it kind of works like this. People saw that valuations were starting to come down, okay? And so rather than invest in companies when they were still thinking about the bubble valuations, they figured, well, if I wait a little longer, you know, I'm going to get a better deal. Okay, that's precisely what has been happening with a lot of these venture funds. I'm personally an investor in six venture funds, none of which are involved with the state. And I was very pleased that one of them, on a personal level, didn't make any capital calls to me because the valuations of the companies they were looking at were coming down. Now they'll probably be making the calls, and the kind of return I'll get personally will be substantially higher than if I had done it at a higher rate. So that's kind of what motivates them. On the other hand, they have to do deals. Okay? So if there's enough capital out there, you know, good deals will get done. If there's a small amount of capital, good deals won't get done. And there's a lot of good deals that aren't getting done. People are really cherry-picking the deals. And as a result, there are companies that are going out of business that are very good companies. So it's a... You know, markets are generally efficient. One of the problems we have in Oregon is that the larger venture firms don't want to come up here because, to them, when they're coming out of Sand Hill Road in Menlo Park, they can turn left on Highway 280 and go to San Jose and deal with the company, or they can turn right and go to the airport and take a plane flight up here. They generally don't do that because they stay focused in that area. The way that we get them up here is to do precisely what these kinds of bills are focused on, and that is to say, okay, we'll put X amount of dollars in your fund, but you have to put a person up here, you have to open an office, and you have to look at Oregon deals, and you have to make your best effort basis to invest that amount that we give you as a limited partner in Oregon, okay? And that's where they bring in the other funds as well. So hope that answers the question.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, Representative Bruce.
Thank you, Mr. Gibson. You mentioned that from 83 to 88, it was something like $500 million.
Over $500 million.
Yeah. Where was that coming from?
That was coming from a number of different funds. We had Shaw Investment Partners in Portland. Olympic Venture Partners was here. Interven was here, which was First Interstate Bank, I think, was Interven's venture partner arm. Mr. Embry had the ORTD whatever it was called, C, A, B, at that point in time. And there was a few others in the state. Plus, my company, for example, had out-of-state venture people like Oak Investments and Mayfield Fund and so forth. And I think Mr. Gibson's company was in the same boat where they had out-of-state VC funds, because what happens is you get the pump prime by an in-state venture capitalist, and they bring in people from out-of-state on good deals, and they build it up. So big funds like Sequoia, Kleiner Perkins, and the others will come up here if there's, you know, if there's a momentum that's occurring within the state. If there's no momentum within the state, if there's no lead people to be on the boards of those companies, they generally won't invest.
Yes. So is that what happened? Where did they go?
So what happened was in that following five-year period from 88 through 93, okay, the amount of venture capital that went into the local funds dropped off to almost nothing. Okay, and as a result, you know, the ability of the local VC people to bring people in from out of state was very limited, and it dried up. I mean, it was a very bad period, and that's what prompted us to start the OGA. And in principle, it is a good organization doing good work and so forth, but it's very small. And we're talking about $1 million a quarter, not very much.
Okay. Thank you
very much.
You bet. Thank you,
Scott Gibson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Gibson. Here today with several hats on, I'm chairman of the board of Radisys Corporation, one of the corporations that the state of Oregon did invest in during the 80s, which is now a NASDAQ company with revenues of just over $200 million a year. I moved here 25 years ago with Intel as part of their migration, and co-founded and was president of Sequent Computer Systems, which 5 years after our founding employed 2,100 people in Oregon on a $5 million initial venture capital investment from Kleiner Perkins and several other ventures, including Shaw Ventures. I'm also here as the capital formation chair of the Oregon Council for Knowledge and Economic Development, affectionately known as OCED. I've chaired that group focusing very much on this venture capital issue since I've been on all sides of the investing equation. In fact, the last 10 years after I left the presidency of Sequent, I've been working with young startup companies trying to get them to become large companies. Companies such as Radisys, TriQuint Semiconductor, Pixelworks are all three examples of companies, and Mr. Barnes' company, Integrated Measurement System, that I've been working with for some time. To the issue of venture capital as an investment, I would also put my hat on as part of the Oregon Health and Science University Board and a member of their investment committee. We commissioned a study of our national advisor in terms of asset allocation, looking at what the top quartile and the top 10 institutions in the nation, what their asset allocations look like between 1992 and 2002. So a substantial flat period, a boom period, and a bust period. That's why we intentionally picked that time horizon. And it was fascinating. The bottom quartile of those institutions all over our nation had 1.8% allocation to venture capital. The top quartile in terms of overall asset return from their entire portfolio had 7.5% allocation to venture capital, four or five times what the bottom performers. The top 10 institutions, of which most of them were prestigious universities like Stanford, had over 10% allocation of their entire corpus in venture capital throughout that 10-year period. So there was an enormous correlation between top-tier returns and a commitment to this particular asset class within private equity venture capital. Now, why do I think this bill is, first off, very, very complementary to the OCED bill that is being heard, in fact, in the Senate committee? What we're trying to do, there will be no new venture capital of other than partners who have a track record. Those are the only people who are going to be able to raise money in this environment. There are, OCED has been working with Northern California and Seattle venture capitalists to get them to consider putting a partner in Oregon to prospect for Oregon opportunities. We have a an incentive bill being heard by the Senator Deckert's committee that would incentivize a partner from one of those firms to move to Oregon, and only give that incentive if that partner invested $2 million per year of their fund in Oregon. This bill would be an enormous help in terms of establishing those partners to move to Oregon. I'll give you an absolute example that's in motion right now. Fraser Capital in Seattle is the largest bioscience venture capitalist in the nation. We have no venture capital, zero, related to the pharmaceutical side, drug development side, and only OVP has said that they'll take a look at the bioinformatics or the more information-intensive sides of bioscience. So OHSU, with the Oregon opportunity and all the investment you made in the last biennium, creating spin-off companies, we have zero venture capital to fund many of those startups. And as a result, they're traveling to Seattle, traveling to California, trying to attract attention. That's a very difficult proposition, because those partners have ample opportunity in Seattle and the Bay Area, and getting on an airplane and wasting a full day is just not, you only do that if you don't have enough deal flow where you are. So Alan Fraser, one of the founders of ImmuneX, which is one of the most successful bioscience companies in the world. Alan Fraser is very interested in doing their second technology fund. They had good results on their first fund. The state of Wisconsin has agreed to put $50 million in their second fund. I'm very interested in the state of Oregon considering putting $50 million in their fund, because that would then have them put a partner in Oregon to consider investing in Oregon. Now, these people are interested in top-tier returns. That means they won't make investments that they don't think their limited partners will benefit from. They won't invest in Oregon, and nor should we mandate that they have to invest in Oregon, because if the deal flow or the quality of the deal or the quality of the entrepreneurs isn't there, we want to give them the freedom that they don't have to invest. It should be a best efforts, and I've suggested amending this bill with that language, a best efforts. I'm very confident, knowing all the folks on the OGA, that they would be an excellent management group to select the venture capitalists. So an independent process that is very experienced with the returns, the people, the track record, the companies, the network to do the reference checks. The OGA, I think, could do an outstanding job selecting where that money goes to make sure it's with people who have top-tier returns. I had this same challenge with my investment committee board at OHSU when I advocated putting money with Alloy Ventures in Northern California and with OVP as their funds opened up. And we were able to demonstrate that those VCs had top-tier returns in every single fund, top quartile returns, and that with that national study that showed the best performing funds had a very heavy allocation to venture capital, the committee unanimously supported $3 million to Alloy and $1 million to OVP. Obviously, our money is not as large as the state's. So I urge your passage of this. I think it will unquestionably bring one or two or three major venture capitalists to Oregon in the form of a partner. I've witnessed now for 25 years what that can do in terms of job creation, and it's exactly the kind of support that people like myself need to keep working with these young companies trying to create jobs for Oregon.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Gibson. Any questions? Representative Lurie.
Hey, you mentioned amendments to this particular thing. Do you have such amendments in process?
Yes. Yes, we do.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Melissa Unger. Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Smith, members of the committee, my name is Melissa Unger, and I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Student Association. And the Oregon Student Association represents all seven public universities, students at all seven public universities, Oregon Health and Science University, and also Lane Community College. We believe that House Bill 3613 is a step in the right direction for creating jobs for the students that we represent. The Oregon Student Association works on issues of access and affordability for post-secondary education. But after these students graduate, there also needs to be access to quality jobs in Oregon. Oregon's graduates are entering an Oregon economy that is uncertain and depressed. We have the highest unemployment in the country. The total number of jobs that exist in Oregon is at the lowest point since 1999. We are graduating students with no jobs to provide them and forcing them to take their earning power out of state. A student who has graduated with a bachelor's degree and makes approximately $20,000 more than a student who graduates with just a high school diploma. It is critical that we keep these high wage earners in the state. As enrollments at colleges and universities are skyrocketing, we are graduating more qualified high school workers than ever before. But as thousands of students graduate, they're being forced out of state because of a lack of jobs. We believe that House Bill 3613 is a way to solve this problem, is a step in the right direction of solving this problem, and we urge you to support it.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Melissa?
Just one.
Sure.
Chair, I want you to know that we agree with your position that it's not good for Oregon to have as one of its top exports be newly graduated university
students. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Harvey Matthews, but I don't see him here. How about Tricia Smith? Good name. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. And, Madam Chair, I'll let you know that someone really smart told me one time that everyone used to be named Smith, and they stayed that way until they messed up.
I told you that.
It could have been you. Could have been you.
Thank you.
Members of the committee, OSEA, first of all, I'd like to say that OSEA supports job creation in Oregon and an economic recovery for our state as soon as we can manage it. And nothing I say with regard to House Bill 3613 should be construed to be contradictory to that statement. However, we have some concerns with House Bill 3613, and I don't want to mention some of the things that the Treasurer mentioned before. We agree with the Treasurer's concerns, but I want to talk about a couple of points in the bill that haven't yet been discussed that I hope that you will, as you're working this bill, that you will consider during that process. In Section 1, Section 1 is a kind of a blanket statement section, and I can't comment on whether or not investments in emerging growth businesses can produce substantial positive returns for long-term investors. But it's a fairly significant statement to make, and I would suggest that before you incorporate that into the statutes, you be sure that that is indeed the case. My concerns, though, deal with Sections 2 and Sections 2 in the bill. In Sub 3, it appears to be adding language to what the OIC should consider as part of the prudent person investor rule, and to include not just whether or not a particular investment is prudent, but whether or not overall it, the OIC must then consider whether overall that investment is prudent in the package of investments that they make. I think that the OIC already does this, and so I don't know that that language in particular is the language I have the most heartburn about. But when we get down to sub 10, sub C, when you put those two together, then I have some concern. Sub C says that not only should the risk analysis be performed, the standard risk analysis should be performed, but also an assessment of the benefits to the state as a whole. As the Treasurer pointed out, some of the funds that the Oregon Investment Council invests don't belong to the state. The PERS fund belongs to PERS members. the Common School Fund belongs to the citizens of Oregon for the perpetuity of education, and there are some significant restrictions on how those funds can be invested according to the prudent person rule. I am concerned that this language at least opens the door to some significant debate about what you mean when you say that the investment is good for the state as a whole. It may be good for the state, but not good for the owner of the fund, for example, if it means a loss or a suppression of return. So I would ask that as the committee works this bill, that you look very carefully at that language and you ask people a whole lot smarter than me on this issue whether or not this language runs afoul with trust law, with prudent person rules, et cetera.
Thank you. Any questions for?
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks.
We're going to call Harvey.
Thank you, Chair Smith, members of the committee. I have copies of testimony from Joe Courtright being passed out. I'd like to go over that with you prior to my final comments on this issue. Joe Courtright, as you may know, served as a chief economic development staff person for the Oregon legislature for a 12-year period in which Oregon produced a number of nationally recognized innovations in development policy, including Oregon benchmarks, sector strategies, workforce policies, and entrepreneurial development. And just to highlight a few of the things that Mr. Courtright mentioned. It says in the first paragraph that House Bill 3613 addresses an important issue to the state's economic development, that is, the ability of the state to contribute to the formation of knowledge-based companies in a limited way. And later on in the second paragraph, he mentions one of the obstacles to that, which is a small state, Oregon, is relatively less endowed with capital, and consequently with the intermediaries for investing in seed and venture capital, less of that than more established states like California. Dedicating a modest portion of state investments to in-state seed and venture capital investments would help trigger the formation of growth of these intermediaries in Oregon and help stimulate the growth of knowledge-based businesses. He goes on to say, I hope that I can contribute to some insight to the current state of the art and state policies toward investment of a portion of pension fund assets in seed and venture capital. The notion that a legislature would establish a policy of dedicating a small portion of state-managed pension fund investments in seed and venture capital investments is not a new or a novel one. It says later in that paragraph, today almost two decades later from when this was originally discussed in 1985, it's difficult to argue that a policy of investing a modest proportion of the state's pension fund assets in such investments is a radical step or one that sacrifices the prudent person rule. And then the last comment that I'd like to draw out is he mentions the South Africa issue in which the legislature took a step there and in directing the Treasurer's Office or the Investment Council. It says, but now, as then, this kind of broad policy direction has virtually no impact on the management or the overall investment returns of the pension funds. Moreover, House Bill 3613 leaves the overall Investment Council discretion and authority completely theirs to wisely select investment managers for the mandated investments and to exercise the same prudence and professionalism in managing these investments as it does for other classes of investments that it makes. So this former advisor to
the legislature on economic development issues during a key period of Oregon economic development says that this is a good thing to do, b a needed thing to do, and c a prudent thing to do. So I wanted to state that for the record. And now for, I'm Harvey Matthews for the record, Harvey from AOI, Associated Oregon Industries. We represent 23,000 of Oregon's businesses and also represent 350,000 private employees. So this we see as a critical economic development bill, not only for the jobs it would create, but for the investment they would get into Oregon. We don't have any venture capital members, so we don't have that conflict, but we do see the importance of this to overall state economic development. You heard today from Senator Bruce Starr that, yes, indeed, other states do this, and the economic impact of this measure is substantial. And from Representative Mitch Greenlick that this is something he did at OHSU. He did feel it was an important piece of state policy, an important directive to make. From Wayne Embry, you heard his experience, so ORTDF, and how well those Oregon-based and British Columbia-based emerging growth businesses grew, and that this is the right time to make these investments. From Keith Barnes, you heard about a couple of studies, one by a 1995 study that Oregon does need venture capital, and also another that Morgan Stanley Capital, looking at over the long term from 1945 to 1990, an 18% average return. And he reemphasized that this is the time to invest more than any other time. And that the market doesn't always work. We, being from a small state, don't have the ability to take advantage of large money, large capital assets. And if we don't do this ourselves, I fear that we will continue to spiral downwards. Scott Gibson, who you just heard from his experience with the OCED's Capital Formation Group, and Melissa Unger with students saying, you know, they need jobs once they graduate. And even Treasurer Edwards himself said there is a need for more capital, that there is a gap between what is out there and what we need. The minimum stated in this bill, $100 million, is a very, very infinitesimal amount of the overall fund. That's about 0.4% of the entire OIC invested or OIC funds. This is a win-win. It creates jobs. It doesn't cost general fund or cause you to have to go out for bonds. This is a directive. It's a political directive, I agree, but this is a political decision. There's when I shopped this idea out in the business community, they said, whoa, you know, watch out. Back in the 80s, there was this PAMCOR thing that blew up, and did a little research into that. And that basically the state directly invested into a economic boondoggle, if you will, where $50 million of private capital took off because it wasn't prudently done. And that, I think, has caused a whole generation of state-invested capital to be taken elsewhere. The political implications of investing in this market are a little bit scary. And unless you give the directive in this way, I fear that will continue not to be done. With that, I just want to reemphasize, it's sound public policy. It's good fiscal policy. The returns are going to be even better for these investments. And it does meet the measure of prudence that we have specified. So I think this bill, if you want to create jobs and if you want to cause the Oregon's economy to explode, this would be the bill to support. And I urge your passage of it, hopefully today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Harvey. Any questions for Harvey?
I have one.
Representative Richardson?
I'm sure. Mr. Matthews, as I go through the bill, and then we take into consideration what was testified today earlier by those that are involved in the OIC and investment in the Treasurer's Office, I see that we're looking for emerging growth, and I looked this up, and it says new and small companies that have capacity to generate jobs and so forth, and yet the Treasurer's Office is talking about $25 million into this fund and so forth, and it's obvious from what I've heard that they're not looking at low or small emerging businesses, but we're looking basically like Sequoia, which is a huge mutual fund. I mean, you invest big money in it and they invest in different things, but they're not looking at emerging businesses in Oregon. And so how do we accomplish the intent of the bill when, once it's passed, those that are going to implement it are dealing with $25 million investments and up?
Thank you. That's an excellent question. To that, a couple of things. One would be, as I've gotten into this, I've learned a lot about the venture capital industry, if you will. And it's a very personal, personality-driven, expertise-driven industry. And so when we're talking about putting money into a fund, those people that manage that fund want to give money to things that they understand. If there aren't jobs or startup ideas in Oregon that don't match that, we aren't going to see those investments. And so I agree that the smaller amounts, more broadly dispersed, would be the better way to do it. Treasurer Edwards also talked about, or I don't believe it was Treasurer Edwards, it was Von Schmitz, that talked about how they take these ideas, they measure them, and then they have them independently looked at by outside consultants. And those outside consultants are not always consultants that have Oregon's best interests in mind. And so to answer your question more directly, I think the Oregon Growth Account would be an excellent way to manage this group of funds. They could easily manage $100 million of funds and make sure that it's dispersed in a proper way. That's not the way it's written in the bill, because in my meetings with the Treasurer's Office, there's been no inclination to work with this idea in any way, shape, or form. And so given that, I wanted to entrust the Oregon Investment Council, which is people are brought forth by the governor's office, as opposed to the Oregon Growth Account, which is chaired by the treasurer. If the treasurer does see this as good public policy, that we do need more capital and it should flow into smaller Oregon companies, then I think if he was to come forward and say, yes, let's do this, let's put it through the Oregon Growth Account that can manage it in the way that the legislature sees fit, and I would be very amenable to that.
Thank you.
Yes. What you said, of course, was that it has a lot to do with the comfort level and the interest of the people, and we've already heard from the head of the Oregon Growth Account, and he's not interested in doing the things that I think that we're trying to do here. I'm not getting a sense from what the treasurer said that he is interested in assuming responsibility to help, to use these funds to help small companies where there's greater liability. Who's going to even do the evaluations of these small companies, because the venture capitalists that we're hearing from are big players. And so I just don't know if we're going to be able to accomplish it, and I'm just wondering how we might accomplish it.
Well, thank you. Another excellent question. Both Keith Barnes and Scott Gibson sit on the Oregon Growth Account, and they are very supportive of this idea and would love the opportunity to manage these funds. Hopefully between those two groups, we get a very prudent decision made there.
Thank you very much. Thank you very
much,
Mr. Matthews. Seeing no one else signed up, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3613. And committee, we're going to stand in recess for just a few minutes as I hit the gavel while we await. And we're going to recess until further notice. So probably Friday we'll have a meeting.
Adjourn until
Friday.